Well, thank you guys for sticking around for the last talk. What I want to tell you about today is an experiment we're doing just down the road at UCLA that we've been having quite a bit of fun with, synthetically cooling molecules with laser-cooled atoms. The outline for my talk is here. I'll start off by just reminding you what synthetic cooling is. I think everybody probably knows. But I'll point out two problems that arise when you try to synthetically cool that you have to handle. And what I'll argue is that charged molecules are the solution to both of those problems. Normally in a talk like this, I would then go on to motivate to you why you'd want to do charged molecules. Typically, I start with the big four, I call it: quantum simulation, quantum computation, precision measurement, and quantum chemistry. And I put a little star, or a little plus sign here, because you can do all four of those with ions as well. So there's the big four plus. There are also some open ion questions that are specific to molecular ions that you just can't address with neutral molecules. But given that this is an expert audience and I don't have a lot of time, and our chair is very serious about me staying on time, I will skip that. And then what I'll do is just move straight to telling you about our experimental results. I'm going to give you what is probably a revisionist history of the actual turn of events, just because it makes more sense if I tell you the way it should have happened instead of the way it actually happened. I'll start off by talking about cooling the molecules translationally in the trap, and then I'll tell you about some recent exciting results cooling the internal states of the molecules with the laser-cooled atoms. All right. But before I do, let me give my acknowledgments in case I run out of time. This is the most important slide. Wade Religer was a postdoc turned research professor who had his hand in sort of everything. Scott Sullivan was a grad student who was instrumental in almost everything I'll show you today. Quang Chen had a lot to do with the initial spectroscopy, and more recently has developed, he's really pushed our understanding of collisions in this ion trap. I would say it's almost groundbreaking what he's done. Steven Showalter has taken the spectroscopy quite far, developed a really ingenious integrated mass spectrometer that I'll show briefly. And he's working with the new postdoc, Christian Schneider, on implementing our second version of the motion trap. Christian forgot to send me a picture. So as you can guess, Christian is from Germany. And of course, it's all centered on Svetlana Kotochikova, who without her help, we would be completely lost. So, all right. So sympathetic cooling. This is probably many of your guys' favorite form of sympathetic cooling. You have a sort of three things to sympathetic cooling. And these three things, even though this is sort of, you know, cutesy, apply in the cold molecule world as well. You know, you have your whiskey or whatever your favorite beverage is. You want to cool it down, so you throw something cold in there, and you need a container, a glass, right? So if you draw this analogy to the cold molecule world to make your cold molecule cocktail, you'll say, well, okay, my whiskey is my molecules, right? I need something to cool that down. I can use laser-cooled atoms. And then you get to the glass, and you start to scratch your head. Because as you know, with neutral molecules, and this is fundamentally the problem that we've all dealt with for the last 10 or 12 years, I would say, is that with lasers or static, you know, or even dynamic electromagnetic fields, the best you can do is about a 10 millikelvin potential. I mean, there are exceptions, but that's sort of the order. So somehow you have to get these things cold enough to hold on to them, and then you can cool them even further, right? Now, charged molecules offer a solution to that. If I take a little battery and put 1 volt on a piece of metal, that's a 10,000 Kelvin high potential, right? And so my glass, if I agree to work with a charged molecule, can simply be an ion trap. I can load in ions at 1,000 Kelvin and trap them for months, right? And then have plenty of time to let them cool down. All right. So the next problem is what we call the vibrational problem. And the best example I know of this comes out of John Doyle's group. So I think we're all familiar with John's work, where he traps in some superconducting magnet, some polar molecules, and cools them down with a helium buffer gas. Now what John found, and others, is that the vibrational decay, or the vibrational quenching rate, is extremely small for neutral atoms on neutral molecules. So small, in fact, that they couldn't measure it even. It's just sort of, in the case of NH, less than about 10 to the minus 15 cubic centimeters per second. So because of this, Wes Campbell, who actually is now my colleague at UCLA, was able to not measure the quenching rate, but instead measure the vibrational spontaneous emission lifetime because the state was so long-lived. Right? And so this this is a problem, you know, if you want to cool these things down. Okay, eventually thermal equilibrium may win, but if it takes you a year to reach thermal equilibrium, you know, it's not really efficient. But it's actually worse than that. You would think maybe you can just wait for thermal equilibrium. But ideally, we'd like to do this at, say, 300 Kelvin sort of, you know, apparatus. So you actually have a competing temperature reservoir now. You have the black body radiation, which can be fairly strongly coupled to your molecule. And so you can't just wait. You actually have to be strong enough to beat or fight back the black body radiation. All right? So we argued in 2009 when we started this, based on some hand-wavy semiclassical arguments, that if you work with a neutral ion system, because the 1 over r to the 4 to the potential is so strong and gives rise to short-range collisions, that you should get near-unit relaxation efficiency for vibrational quenching cross-section. So almost every collision should give you vibrational relaxation. All right? And you'll have to stick around to the last bit of the talk to see if that's true or not. All right, so that's the idea. Use charged molecules, you can trap them. They should be able to be cooled down quite quickly. And so how do you actually do this? Well, it's simple. We combine a magneto-optical trap and an ion trap. When you do that, it forms the word motion, so we call it a motion trap. And it's actually a pretty rich system, I think, as you probably heard earlier in the week from maybe Stefan Willich and others. You know, you can study atom-ion interaction, quantum chemistry, quantum information, and as I'll show you today, make cold molecular ions. But the thing in quotes here is the thing that's important to the, you know, sort of the poor experimentalist, that it's proven technology. It's a mott and an ion trap. I mean, they're not quite turnkey systems, but they're not far from it. So you get a lot of time thinking about the science and less time, you know, relocking laser number 23. All right, and also I should say, you know, people like Mikhail Drusen have shown the way to all kinds of interesting things you can do with ions that we haven't had in the cold molecule world of, you know, I could have a few, you know, a mini ion crystal, a few ion crystal, all the way down to one, and because these ions push each other away, it's easy to address them individually, it's easy to resolve them. And so there are all sorts of possibilities for chemistry and quantum information here, I think. All right. So what does it look like? You know, a pretty standard atomic physics experiment, a vacuum chamber, lots of optics. The blue light is from our calcium mott, which is what we use as the sort of buffer gas in our experiment. If you were to look through this window here, you would see an ion trap, and in the middle, there's some trapped ions. If, say, you look down this vacuum flange here, when the mott is on, you just see, you know, a nice little calcium mott floating in the middle of the ion trap. Now, this will become a little more apparent why we chose calcium, which, you know, is not the nicest mott, right? There are lots of, it's a little bit more problematic than something like rubidium. But the main reasons are that it has a low mass, you'll see why that's important, and it has a reduced reactivity. I mean, if you think about it, ions are, you know, pretty reactive creatures. Laser cool atoms are usually pretty reactive as well. So we want to put things together that don't react away immediately. All right, so in our first implementation, we didn't jump straight to molecular ions because, you know, that was quite hard. We started off with something very simple, just using ytterbium ions. Now, we chose ytterbium because it has the same mass to charge ratio as the molecular ion we want to use. And so all the kinematics should be the same in the ion trap. Now, from that, we were able to characterize the ion trap, sort of make sure we knew what we were doing at least a little bit. And we got a whole lot of unexpected atom ion chemistry, which I'm not going to talk about here, but some nice results from Wade and Scott and well, everybody here. But what I want to talk about today is not that, but the cooling. So the first thing you would do is say, okay, do these ytterbium ions get cold, right? Because the mott should cool them down, right? Ytterbium's nice because there's just a more or less cycling transition. You can just measure the Doppler width and see how cold it gets. Right? Now, and this is a mini ion cloud, and that's going to be important later. When you do that, you see something like this. When the MOD is not off, and this is just a Doppler fluorescence profile, you see an ion temperature that's almost 800 Kelvin, right? That is, you know, okay, the fact that that's not 300 Kelvin is understood, and you'll see why later. And then you turn on the MOT and you see, well, there is cooling, but it only cools down to about 600 Kelvin, right? And so evidently, I mean, since you know you've introduced a temperature reservoir that's at a millikelvin, there must be some other heat loads that are fighting you back, right? Now, this isn't completely unexpected. There's a phenomenon called micromotion interruption, which I'm going to tell you about in the next few slides, that allows you to couple energy in from the RF field into the ions during a collision process, right? And that can, you know, fight back against this cooling, right? All right, so let me give you just a very simple introduction to micromotion interruption. Imagine you have a normal harmonic oscillator and a ball rolling back and forth. This is really the John Doyle type experiment. Now, the ball rolls up this way, and on its way up, it has a collision that's sort of the ultimate cooling collision. It stops the molecule or stops the ball. What happens? Well, the trajectory looks something like this. It oscillates back and forth. It has the ultimate cooling collision. So what does the trajectory look like from this point forward? It's just a cosine, right, of this amplitude with t equals 0 defined as the collision time. And so it just looks like this. And it always looks like that. And you always get cooling in a harmonic trap. In an ion trap, you don't have sines and cosines. You have the Matthews sines and cosines, which are funny animals because they know about the RF phase. And so what happens is you're going along, and you have something that looks very similar, but you can see the micromotion. You have a collision, and most of the time, you go away with a reduced amplitude. Most of the time, you do get cooling. If this is cooling with, say, you know, this is a stopping collision, right? But occasionally, if you have a collision at the wrong time of the RF phase, you can actually come away with more energy than you started with, right? Now, there are three, four different ways to explain this, but fundamentally what's going on is the Matthew trajectory, on average, has some energy, right? And so energy goes into and out of the ions, into the field and out of the field. Now, if you have a collision, the collision is what's dominating the trajectory. It says, you know, the trajectory is now given by this thing I'm colliding with. And the RF potential is then just some perturbative field that can now do net work on the ions. So, I mean, in the simplest case, imagine you are coming this way with micromotion, and you bounce off, and you're going this way. Suddenly, you're out of phase completely with the RF, and it can do work on you to bring you back into phase. And you come away, even though you stopped, with higher energy overall, right? So this is the phenomenon of micromotion interruption, which was, you know, more or less known in hand-wavy ways. What's happened in the last 6 months to a year is our student Quang Chen has developed a completely analytical theory that describes both the steady state and the dynamics of this phenomenon. So he can do things, I mean, I'm not gonna go into great detail, but he can do things like write down equations that tell you what your final temperature will be depending on the masses and the atoms and the trap parameters. And so you can see this is just a plot of temperature where one is sort of the same temperature as your buffer gas. You see as you go to heavier mass, the temperature starts to scream up. You can actually, you know, eventually that mass, the mass of your buffer gas gets so high that even if it's at 0 Kelvin, you always get heating. Right, because effectively you're always sort of bouncing off the other way. Quang can also write down equations for this critical mass, what this you know the biggest mass you can cool with, and compared to simulations, you can see this you know it sort of agrees perfectly. Now this is really following in the footsteps of people like Daymelt, DeVoe, and a guy named Moriwaki who really worked a lot of this out maybe 10 years ago. But you can see that Quang has actually sort of split the uprights with, you know, the Daymelt result is sort of approximation, the same for the DeVoe. Moriwaki gets the dependence right, but not the actual value. In addition to the steady state, he can also tell you about the dynamics. I won't go into great detail here, but this is the energy as a function of time, so this is the relaxation time. You can write down some expression for that, and you see that there are certain masses which are optimal, but as you get too heavy, you go to where you always heat. So the rules of thumb are not that different from sort of what was known in the ion community, I would say. But I think now we can be quantitative about it. And the rules are this. Look, you want a really low buffer gas mass, the lower the better. That's why we work with calcium. And you want a low MathUQ, right? These low MathUQ is sort of just always true in ion trap. For those of you that don't know about ion traps, the MathUQ is just a parameter that is given by your RF potential and trapping frequency and your trap geometry, right? And so this gives you actually, I mean, it's one of the probably the biggest takeaways is there's a fundamental limit to an ion that you can cool given your buffer gas. So if you're using rubidium, you're limited to molecules that are heavier than 110 AMU. If you're using calcium, you can get down to about 50. So, you know, we'd like to go to something like beryllium, but, you know, right now those mods aren't really feasible. All right. So this is actually, you know, this is all understood now, I would say, but this is not the dominant heat load in the ion trap. This is not the thing setting the temperature. The thing that's setting the temperature is or ion-ion collisions. So it turns out that the ions themselves can interrupt the other ion's micromotion and allow you to couple in energy from the trap fields. I won't go through how you get to this equation. It's not terribly hard. And it's just based on an extension of the theory that I showed you earlier. The important points are that this tells you the heating rate. So, right, so this is the time derivative of your temperature due to this ion-ion effect, this interruption. And you see that it's lots of things in here that you know, your ion density, the mass, the temperature. There's a term here which accounts for if you haven't compensated your trap just perfectly. But there's one term that you may not have seen before, at least if in atomic physics. And that's this term called log lambda, which is known as the Coulomb logarithm in plasma physics. And it comes about because at one point when you're deriving this, you have to do an integral over the 1 over the impact parameter. And that blows up at both ends. And so Landau was the first person to figure out how to handle this. He said, look, I know at the long range, this falls off because there's the Debye screening, right? So I don't have to integrate to infinity. I know at the short range, this falls off because there's a distance of closest approach. You know, KT is equal to E squared over R. That's called the Landau length, RC. So you integrate this, you get natural log of lambda D over RC, and people call that log lambda. Right. Now, it turns out that there's a pretty big effort within the plasma community to determine log lambda. And people like Tom Killian have actually made some headway recently using ultra-cold plasmas to determine these numbers. But historically, the story goes, it starts with Landau. Spitzer picked this up and a few others. And along the way, they said, well, it's not really lambda D over RC. When you include all the factors, you should have a 0.76 here. And the plasma guys won't call this lambda D over RC. They call that 1 over G. G is their strong coupling parameter. In atomic physics, we have a gamma, which is closely related to G, but is not. So gamma, if you've heard about ion crystals, is a thing that's got to be 170 before you have a crystal. G is sort of their analog of that. Right. So in 2008, Guy Diamante and Jerome Dalligat had a pretty big result within the plasma community, where they used these giant supercomputers at Los Alamos to simulate a plasma and extract from that a value of log lambda. And their value is just basically an extension of this that works when G gets bigger than about 0.76. Right? Now, we obviously, you know, can't do this sort of level of computation for the ion trap, but we do know everything in this equation except log lambda. So we can turn this around and measure the Coulomb logarithm. And what you get is shown here. So the dots are experiment and simulation. The blue curve is the Landau-Spitzer result, which you see works at low G. The three colors here are the gas, liquid, and solid phase of the ion trap, or of the ions. The black curve is the Diamante and Dalligat result. And the red curve is sort of air fit to what we've determined. Right? And we see that it's sort of piecewise, and right around G equals 1, which is near the gas to liquid boundary, there appears to be a change in the behavior. And we can actually make some hand-wavy arguments as to why this should go as 1 over G squared. Now, you shouldn't read this as we're saying to the plasma community, hey, guys, you got it wrong. This is what it is. You should read this as, this is what log lambda is in an ion trap. using this prescription. So we expect that we will deviate in this region, because as you go to high G, holy crap, it's getting shit out of me, man. All right. I get an extra 5 minutes just for that. So we expect that as you go to high G, this description is going to fail, because we base this on this Matthew trajectory description of the ion trap, and we know as you go to a liquid and a solid, that breaks down. And so that error in our description, we've absorbed into log lambda. So that's a problem if you want to compare to the plasma community, but if you're an ion trapper, it doesn't matter. This log lambda is universal for ion traps. We've explored this in different geometries, and you always get this value. And so now we can do really cute things very easily. Here's an experiment where we laser cool an ion sample down to a really low temperature. Then we turn off the laser cooling and let it heat up due to this ion-ion heating. What you see is it stays cold for a while, and then it heats up very slowly, which you can't see, but eventually it gets to the point where this crystal starts to turn into a liquid, and the ions start to become uncorrelated, and they can heat very quickly. They melt into a gas phase. Then once it's in the gas phase, the heating slows down because the density is dropping. Right? This line is just a numerical integration of that formula I've showed you before. And so it reproduces what we see in the experiment very well. We can also use it to calculate the density, the heating rate, the structural phase, all with, What's kind of interesting, sort of beyond what we're doing, is that this melting time, where this, this thing sort of turns into a gas, is a fairly simple expression. And this tells you an upper limit for how long your ion crystal can live in the dark. And so this is important for people doing quantum simulation, quantum computation, because they have to turn off their laser cooling to implement quantum gates. And so if you know your parameters, this will tell you what's the longest time you have to implement gates in your simulation. All right, so we now have a pretty good understanding of this. And the bottom line is, in that our current version of the motion trap, we can't significantly cool the translational motion. But that's okay. We had a solution in our back pocket all along, which was that, well, we have atomic ions around. We can laser cool them and let them sympathetically cool the molecular ions, just like Mikhail Drusen has been doing for years. Then we can turn on our neutral atom cloud to relax the internal degrees of freedom. So it's a two-stage sympathetic cooling. And so I'll tell you about that experiment now. So the experiment looks something like this, same sort of trap. There's a calcium ion. We now have barium ions, and barium chloride is our molecular ion, which I may not have mentioned yet. The question is, does it work? Well, the translationally cold that's easy, right? You laser cool the barium ions, this thing just cools right down. Drusen has shown us the way here. And now the question is, well, is this calcium mot really relaxing the internal degrees of freedom as we hoped? Right. To prove that, you need spectroscopy, right? You'd like to have, do spectroscopy of when it's warm, you see some forest of lines, you cool it down, and you see that collapse into just a few lines, and you can back out your internal state population. Well, if you know about molecular ions, you know that you've now hit a problem, because there's almost no spectroscopy for molecular ions. In fact, when we started this, we only knew two things about barium chloride. There was an estimate that its dissociation energy was around 38,000 wave numbers, and we knew that it had to dissociate into barium. So we grabbed a laser, turned it to 38,001, and tried to see if we could blow this thing apart and looked for the appearance of barium. And if we didn't see it, we just kept turning up the laser weight energy. To do that, Stephen built this beautiful device here, which unfortunately I don't have time to talk about, but it integrates a time-of-flight spectrometer with a linear ion trap. That sounds like something that should have been done a long, long time ago, but there are actual challenges that are hard to overcome, and he had some pretty ingenious solutions to this. But because of this device, we can look for this sort of dissociation spectroscopy in the following way. We have some target barium chloride 2 that we laser ablate. That gives us a sample of barium and barium chloride ions in the trap. You can change the trap stability to throw away all the atomic ions, and you're just left with molecular ions. Then we introduce a pulse dye laser to hopefully blast this thing apart and make barium, and then you kick it out and just do time of flight. And the data looks something like this. You'll see that when the laser is off, you have something like 800 ions. When the laser is on, you see that you lose about 100 barium chloride ions, and you look at the barium peak, and you see that it's grown by about 100. And Stephen has gotten to the point where, you know, the error bars on this are now plus or minus a couple ions, and so we can see dissociation rates of, you know, tenths of a percent or less, or dissociation fractions of that order. So using this, you just, you know, map this dissociation out as a function of wavelength, because you have to get a handle on this molecule somehow. And when you do that, you see some broad photodissociation cross-section here. Now, we got this and we went to Svetlana and said, Svetlana, please help us out. What should we be expecting? She did these beautiful calculations and explained, as you can see from her calculation, our result perfectly. The ground state is a singlet sigma plus. We're dissociating to a singlet pi and detecting the barium. Now, this is great. You know, we learned a lot about the molecule, and you know, previous to this, there were no potentials of this molecule. Literally nothing was known. But this doesn't help you so much when you're trying to prove that you're cold, because this is some giant, you know, broad cross-section. Right. In fact, if you look at the individual contributions from the vibrational wave functions, you see here's V equals 0, here's V equals 1. These look just like the square of the vibrational wave functions for a reason. This is the reflection principle, right? There's a node here because, you know, the V equals 1 has a 0 crossing, that vibrational wave function. You see that, look, even if we could cool this all into V equals 0, this cross-section would barely change, right? So we sort of were at an impasse in the sense of, well, you know, we may have cold molecules, but we can't really prove it. And necessity, I guess, is the mother of invention. And so we did something which we've been calling photodissociation thermometry. And the way it works is by realizing that the V equals 1 cross section has a node in it because, you know, the V equals 1 wave function has a node. So if I tune my laser to this wavelength, and I look at, and here's some sort of model of the bottom of this potential where I have V equals 1 and V equals 0 molecules, and I dissociate, I'm going to dissociate the V equals 1 molecules away, or V equals 0 molecules away. But if I turn on my MOT, I can pump those down into V equals 1 and then dissociate those again. And so I can get an enhancement in my photodissociation rate. conversely, I can tune to this antinode of V equals 1. And then if I turn on the MOT, I can actually push the photodissociation away. So I can get a signal that both goes positive and both goes negative. So you know, sort of believe that it's not just some overall systematic effect. Now, if you look at what that enhancement and suppression ratio should be as a function of wavelength, you can make some curves that look like this. So if you do nothing, you get this blue line. If you get about 90% in the ground state, you get the red line, and 100% is the green line. And the data looks something like this. So somewhere between 90 and 100%. I don't really want to focus too much on the value of this because, well, one, it's not that impressive. But you know, there's a lot of things we could do better. Like, for example, make the ion cloud smaller than the calcium mot, which was sort of forced on us by some stupid imperfections in our trap. What I want to draw your attention to, though, is that if you extract from this the quenching rate, right? This was the number that was 10 to the minus 15 for neutral molecules. We find that it's about 10 to the minus 9 cubic centimeters per second for molecular ions. This is about a fifth of the Langevin rate. So it means, you know, almost one in every five collision is relaxing the internal vibrational state. Right? And so why is that? You know, why do we have this sort of factor of 10 to the 6 over neutral molecules? Well, no one's done a really, you know, a full quantum mechanical calculation yet, but here's what we think is going on. You have this 1 over r to the 4 potential, right? Now, if it's classical collision, that crosses the origin, right? Once you're within sort of the Langevin impact parameter, that collision will go through the origin before it goes out. Quantum mechanically, that means it's a short-range collision, or short-range collisions can happen. And so the way we view it is, well, the calcium comes in, and it gets so close to the barium and the chlorine that it's just as close as they are to each other. And so it's almost like a little three-body complex. And now this vibrational energy, which is in barium chloride, can very easily go to the calcium, and it takes it away when it predissociates. All right, so let me just summarize and wrap up. Hopefully I convinced you that molecular ions solve the sympathetic cooling problem and that the motion trap is a reasonable approach to that. I told you about some of the interesting, I guess thermodynamics is the best word I have for this right now. It's not really thermodynamic equilibrium, it's more, you know, non-equilibrium steady state, but nonetheless. And then I told you about our efforts using two-stage cooling to make cold molecular ions. What I didn't have time to talk about is the work of Christian and Stephen constructing sort of our motion 2.0, which is going to solve a lot of these problems. We'll have single ion resolution, so we'll be able to cool the translational degree of freedom. We're going to add TOF capabilities so that we can answer some of these open questions about atom ion chemistry, which I didn't get to talk about. And then just sort of overall, we should be able to, we think, to go much farther in that version. All right, thank you guys.
Victor. Sorry, my question is not about cooling, it's about use of a molecular ion. I have two questions. Can they be used for parity violation, like sigma 1/2, p 1/2 terms? I know that Dedi Mill is doing neutrals, but is it possible to do parity violation with molecular ions?
I don't know why not. Off the top of my head. I mean, like lead oxide plus, we talked
about.
Yeah,
we did calculations for plenty of ions. They right. All should be sigma 1/2 or p 1/2.
Right, I mean, off the top of my head, I don't know. I mean, maybe Dave has thought about this, but it seems to me that all those things more or less translate to molecular ions. You still have plenty of, you know, internal states.
Yeah, it's probably easier to trap ions rather than neutrals.
It's definitely easier to trap them. Yeah, I mean, depending on, well, we'll see how far this goes, but so far, so good.
And second question about search for variation of fundamental constant. Have you thought about ions? I'm sure you did. What do you think?
I mean, we've thought about it, Victor, but you know, we've sort of just had our heads down lately trying to show that all the cooling can be done. I mean, these molecules that you sent me, lead oxide plus, I think.
I
don't see any reason that you can't do these things with molecular ions. I mean, it all just comes from the fact that you're driving states internally and measuring, you know, frequencies. Ions still have frequency, you know, internal transition. So.
Okay, so please look for this when your head will be up.
Look, the one challenge is this. Here's the one challenge of this, is the chemistry. So there, you know, we know right now of about 30 molecular ions that work with this technique. And so the nice thing is, or that should work with this technique, it's pretty general, right? You just throw anything in an ion trap. You don't actually even need a laser for your molecule. But the one thing you have to worry about are chemical reactions, right? And we chose barium chloride because if you think about it, what does barium chloride look like? Well, it's a barium ion, which has one electron, and a chlorine ion, or chlorine atom, which wants that electron. So when it forms, it's an ionically bonded closed shell atom, so it's not very reactive. Often, you're going to want radicals. And those, I don't know.
Yeah, but radicals for N-pole measurements, right. For parity violation measurements, for variation, you don't need radicals. Okay.
Yeah, Derek. I think I didn't get the point. How do you tune your photodissociation laser to the node of vehicle one or to the maximum?
Right. Okay. So
I'm not sure I got it.
So it's a tricky. There's sort of a transform that sort of is happening behind the scenes here. So the reflection principle, right? You have your, if you do your Frank-Condon overlap, the only part that really contributes because it's so oscillating on top is the part right near the wall. And so whenever you have a photon of a certain energy, it effectively forces on you a distance that transition happens at. And so then the wave then so if you tune to a certain wavelength, the V equals zero, V equals one, just doesn't photodissociate.
Yeah, but in that, at the same frequency, you would have also a chance to catch V equals zero ion and to dissociate them.
Right, that's what we use. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
We use that. So what we use is this different dissociation between V equals zero and V equals one.
Okay.
Effectively, what it is, it's an experimental way of dividing the two cross sections and dividing out a lot of noise.
Okay,
that's
see.
Really all it is.
Okay, it's kind of a differentiation
effect. It's just a simple way of dividing out all kinds of common mode noise.
Okay.
That's really all it is. Yeah.
A common, so you find the vibrational quenching is much more efficient, and what you showed first for the molecule was the NH,
right.
And that was supposed, if it would have happened, it would have been collisions with helium. So I just want to point out, I mean, the mass difference there is huge, and the interaction
tiny, yeah.
So it makes perfect sense that it is
much more
efficient.
No, that's definitely true, but I mean, you can extend these arguments to bigger masses, and there's still a huge disparity in the numbers. Even helium can quench molecular ion vibrational states okay, I think. I mean, not as well as this, but okay.
Yeah, but then it's the interaction with the ions that is
right.
much stronger that's
right,
driving
exactly.
it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So there is, talking of helium, I mean, there is a whole industry of people out there who usually have a 22-pole trap, and they do helium buffer gas cooling of vibrational motion, and quite successfully, I think.
Right, yeah.
And I just wonder what advantages are there of using a MOT to do vibrational cooling over helium buffer gas?
Well, it's not the vibration. So what? Vibration is fine. It's the rotation, right? So with helium, you can't get below 300 millikelvin, right? That's the lowest you can do. Here, you can go to whatever your Mach temperature is, as long as you account for the micromotion. So though we can't, so in the current version, right, we can't prove that we've cooled rotationally. But John Doyle saw even with helium, he could cool the rotation like crazy. So we expect that we're cooling the rotation. So you want to use the laser cooled atoms so that you can get to the true real vibrational ground state, which you just can't get to with helium, at least in most molecules.
So you think you can get right down to thermodynamic equilibrium between in the rotational degree of freedom?
So to do that, though, you either have to have if you want to do it with just a Mach, you have to have very few ions. So one to a linear chain. Once you go above a linear chain, it just won't work. Unless maybe you can have some atomic ions and just really laser cool them a lot, but it also depends on the ion as well.
Actually, Eric, you just answered the question that I was going to ask, which was about rotation, which you can't measure, but as you gave your view about it, so I'll just transmute the question slightly and say, if the molecular ion has internal spin structure or hyperfine structure, I guess whether it quenched or not would depend on whether that was fast enough that the collisions would be sufficient to do that.
Yeah, I mean, really, so as long as you're, so in that case, I think the question is maybe not the time, it's not whether it's fast enough. I think it will happen because you can wait in this case, because there's not a lot of black body typically at those energy scales, right? Now, the bigger question is probably, are you cold enough to do that? If you have super hyperfine or something like that, that's generally a pretty small temperature. And in an ion trap, you may have to go to BC type single ion stuff to get there.
Yeah, what I would like to do is make a comment, because you have these wonderful results here on this thermodynamics and these collisions. One of the things is that the people in these ion storage rings, they see similar processes. They call this intrabeam scattering.
Right.
And your logarithm that occurs exactly there. And I wonder how your analysis.
Right. So they do. Yeah. They see effectively. They usually report I'm not going to go all the way back, but effectively the derivative of this temperature curve. They see this, that the heating rate is really quick and then it falls off. Yeah. I am not 100% sure that I've seen them extract the Coulomb logarithm from it. But I remember early on we compared to it, at least qualitatively it was the same. I don't know if we ever got quantitative. What I can say we've done is, we changed the trap geometries, and this is, in simulation, and no matter what, we always get the same sort of value for the linear trap.
Yeah. There's a question that I would have. It also goes a little bit along the lines you were asking, Tim was asking. So we did sometimes, we did experiments on these high pole traps where we looked at thermalization with the buffer gas.
Right.
And I wonder when you take your analysis now and you would go to a higher pole trap, like 8 pole or I don't know, how would the results you get or the conclusions that you draw, how would they change?
We'd have to think about that. I would say fundamentally not that different, but you know, there's always factors of 5/3 and things that come into these.
But micro motion is strongly suppressed, of course, in these.
Yeah, but you know, so is the trap depth, right? Like until you go out. So it's sort of like there's some conservation that, well, the trap's just bigger and then.
This is not what we found.
Okay. Oh, we should talk. It'd be interesting because I think it's pretty straightforward to take this to there. It's just basically a recalculation of some conservation of energy and momentum and collision.
Yeah, that would be great.
I just had a comment about the mathematical unity of these results, which is intriguing to me, that the classical mechanics of the cooling and the ion motion comes down to Mathieu functions, and the ion neutral quantum mechanics at low energy is a Mathieu problem. The quantum defect theory is formulated entirely in terms of Mathieu functions since 1980. I think this is a beautiful Mathieu function world you're exploring.
Yeah, so I guess I would just reemphasize what you said, that it seems like the place where you get a big bang for the buck of trying to do sympathetic cooling with laser-cooled atoms is in the rotational motion.
Right, yeah,
That's something where for anything other than a hydride, you just can't do it all the way to the ground state with ordinary buffer gas. But then that leads to the question, how are you going to tell? Do you have a plan for how you're going to measure the rotational temperature in your system?
So our hope is that some, you know, spectroscopists will feel sorry for us soon. And no. So we have two approaches. One is sort of the sort of more, you know, straightforward approach. And as we're working on taking rotationally resolved spectroscopy using multiphoton dissociation of the barium chloride molecule. We don't know if that's going to work yet. The potentials aren't really well known well enough. We have some idea, and here's the following argument, which is very hand-wavy right now, is that the rotational transition in barium chloride is about 6 gigahertz, right, which is quite a bit of energy. And so if it's relaxing at near the Langevin rate, that whenever it relaxes, it's going to kick out a calcium atom probably, right? And so if we can shine in microwave and just pump this transition, you know, really strongly, maybe we can infer that we're driving it by seeing loss in the Mott. And so the idea is, you know, you just sit there and turn the knob and look for the Mott to get dim. So that's what we're going to try first because we know how to do that and it's easy. I don't know if it's really going to work, but that's sort of what's up.
So I would like to see some data when you do the temperature measurement, but you haven't cooled yet. Yeah. How does it look like?
So it's very different if you approach from above and below, right? But there are different, there are more than one solution to these things. Yeah, so in the stuff I showed, we cooled to a crystal effectively so that we could start out with very known conditions and watch what happens. When we haven't cooled yet, it was sort of what I showed you before of where we had sort of an 800 Kelvin Doppler profile that we could cool to only 600 Kelvin. Right. So, and that's just because of this ion heating goes as n squared, and you know we can't right now we don't have the ability that you guys have of working with you know one ion, and so we have to work with many ions. In the next version, we hope to be there, and then I think we can be there.
Yeah, I was just wondering, would that help if you do threshold photodissociation? Because right now you just shine your laser because this is, I guess, the one that you got, right?
We tried.
Yeah?
Yeah, we've tried lots of things. So it's actually expected that there should be a strong predissociation channel in barium chloride, and that's why we picked barium chloride. Stephen spent about, I don't know, 6 months to 8 months of his life looking for it. It's just not there. So I don't know. We haven't been able to drive the threshold for dissociation, and we haven't been able to drive pre-dissociation. I would love to show you the molecular potentials and the data and see what you think about it.
Okay. Thanks.
Coming back to your rotational cooling, presumably your rotational cooling has to compete with the black body radiation heating, and that, I don't know what the vibrational frequency of
barium chloride. So the vibrational frequency of barium chloride is atrocious. It's 300 wave numbers. So the rotational is a little bit better. So if the fact that we're seeing vibrational relaxation, I think, means unless something really weird is going on, that the rotation is going to be fine.
Okay.
You know, once we start working with small enough. But this is barium chloride, right? It all changes depending on.
More questions? Okay, let me ask about the big four plus. So what kind of regimes do you have to get into, and sort of what is your process for getting into them to address, oops, sorry, each of these four areas?
Well, first I have to remember them all. So people like Dave working with Dave Schuster have shown ways of doing quantum computation with molecular ions. And so this is trapping a molecular ion on a chip next to a strip line resonator, right? So those are the things you have to be able to do. Ion trapping is, you know, okay on a chip. Hopefully by the time we get there, you know, Chris Monroe and others will figure it out, have figured out all the problems. So that's what's gonna happen there. For, you know, the quantum chemistry stuff, people are already doing it. I mean, you probably heard about it earlier in the week from, you know, Johannes and Stefan,
yes,
and Mikhail. For, you know, quantum simulation, it's an interesting idea because, you know, you can have gigantic dipole moments. Barium chloride is something like 10 dB, right? But generally, it's going to be swamped by the monopole, right? Unless you maybe do something like what Eric Cornell has for his EDM trap, where there's a rotating electric field, right? Then maybe you can start to see effects. Probably that, I don't know, that seems hard to me. What's more likely, I think, are molecular ion analogs of what Chris Monroe is doing, simulating quantum magnetism, but now you have extra internal degrees of freedom. I mean, I don't, no one has, you know, worked that through, but it seems like there could be some physics there. And then precision measurement, it's the same thing as what Victor is asking, that look, there are lots of internal states, you just look for some, you know, happy coincidence and go off and measure.
Okay, well, thank you for telling us about this very promising area. Let's thank all the speakers. Thank you for sticking it out to the end, and I'm supposed to tell you from KITP staff that the shuttle will go soon. That's why we have to end at 5:30. And I think if you're going to the hotel and you get a bit stuck, the hotel can send the shuttle later, and I can help you figure that out. But there's a number by the door. You can call this number, and they send the shuttle every 30 minutes or an hour. So, okay. Thank you again. It's been an honor to have everyone here at this conference and have so much dialogue, and I feel very good about it. Thank you. Thank you.